You know, before, you know, I actually went to a gym setting doing this, I was doing it in the streets. You know what I mean? If a kid had a dispute or something, you know, I'll make him throw the gloves on and, you know, we're going to get it out the way right here, right now. You know what I mean? You don't have to wait on a referee. You don't have to wait on a doctor. You don't have to even wait on the fighters to submit. You can get up there if you see something, if you feel something, despite of what the crowd going to say or what people say after the fact, you have to do what's best for your fighter, you know, that you think is best for the fighter. So you get up and you stop it. You stop it. When he said that, of course, it took me for a loop. I'm sitting there, I don't know what to do. And I cried my eyes out. And I call home, call my mom. And I'm talking about, I'm boo-hooing, man. And still, I got to find a way to get myself together because we still got to perform. Tony was going to fight at the Playboy Mansion.
Hello, and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Chris Dix.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oliver was child's play compared to that one?
I still get goosebumps to this day.
you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
I shouldn't have beaten me. He said, well, let's pull you back.
And the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
There's winning, and there's nothing else.
Hello and welcome back to Boxing Life Stories. This week I've been in Washington, D.C., where I've been speaking to top trainer Barry Hunter. Barry is the head of the Headbangers Boxing Gym, which is based out of the Bald Eagle Rec Center in Southwest Washington, D.C., and is best known for churning out a number of top-ranked protégés, including Lamont and Anthony Peterson. But he's worked with countless other top pros and top amateurs through the American amateur boxing system. He's worked with the likes of Gary Russell, and then going further forwards as a pro, he's worked with Adrian Broner, he's worked with heavyweight Tony Thompson. It's not quite an endless list, but it's getting there. And I really enjoyed Barry's company. Barry is a top guy. We just basically sat and talked for an hour and 10 minutes, and his gym gradually got more and more full to the point where I was like, you're gonna have to go and do some work now, because people were looking through the door. And more and more guys were getting ready, gloved up, ready to spar. And they wanted to catch Barry's eye and they wanted him to watch over their sparring. So I was going to say I left him to it. I didn't. I went and watched the sparring with him. And it was we had a great time. I was felt very welcome there at the boxing gym. And I felt very welcome by Barry. It was great to speak to him. We'd not had a long conversation before, if any conversation at all. For those who follow my social media channels and for those on Patreon, you will know that I've spent the best part of a couple of weeks in America recently researching my book on Matthew Saad Muhammad. I've been out there spending time with his old friends from back in the day. It was good to go to Philadelphia, among other places, where I paid my respects to Matthew and to Smoking Joe Frazier, who's buried not far from Matthew. And it was good to meet Mike Everett and his brother Eddie Everett as well. Brothers of the late wonderfully talented Tyrone Everett. Before I leave you with Barry Hunter, I did mention Patreon there. If you are interested in sponsoring this podcast or just backing the podcast, say show your appreciation for Boxing Life Stories, by all means visit my Patreon page. Visit patreon.com/TristDixon and support me and the podcast for as little as £5 a month. We are brought to you by two sponsors. We have Hanson Lee Resourcing, who were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, they help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance, who are a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide. They provide expert impartial advice on all aspects of fire, health and safety compliance. And you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. Before I leave you with Barry Hunter, thank you very much for the positive feedback on the recent episodes, including with Bob Hattrack and Matt Christie and Harlem Eubank. And I'm very grateful for those of you who have taken the time to listen. And I really hope you enjoy this with the brilliant Barry Hunter. So, Barry, thanks so much for having me down to the gym. It's great to see you.
You're more than welcome.
So the big story, obviously, or one of the big stories to come from this gym was that You took Lamont Peterson under your wing when he was 10 years old. What were you doing when you were 10 years old?
Oh, wow. I was 10 years old. I was actually living on the south side of D.C. right after the riots in 68. I think I got over there at the age of 9, and that's when I was first introduced to sports. And one of the first sports that I actually played was baseball at Benestar Rec Center. That's where I learned about boxing, basketball, baseball, football, was through D.C. Parks and Rec.
Okay.
Yeah, and here years and years later, I'm still a part of the rec system.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, obviously there's a stereotype within boxing that boxing straightens out a lot of kids and people who went down the wrong path. Did you ever go down the wrong path?
Of course, I lived in the projects. After the riots in 68, we moved from the north side of D.C., northeast to be exact, and we moved to southeast, which I didn't know the difference. I didn't know, you know, about that hard life and the projects and things of this nature. You know, as far as I was concerned, it was an upgrade from where we lived at before, right? But then, you know, I quickly learned the first day that we were moving in, my parents was actually moving the furniture and our articles in the front door. I was in, which was going to be my bedroom, and being threatened inside my bedroom by two guys on the outside of our house underneath my window, you better not come outside. And that's where it started at, right? You know, and so I had to hit the ground running. It was the first time that I had actually been threatened like that. And it was a shock to me. And so, you know, even at that early age, I knew then that I had to learn something, you know. And I was around it all day, every day. But my saving grace was through sports and art via music.
Okay. What kind of music?
Drums.
Okay. Do you play the drums now?
I haven't played the drums in so many years, man.
But that's a hidden talent.
But drums were, it was just like sports, it was an escape for me. You know what I mean? And the crazy part about it, when I got to the projects, my dad lived still in Northeast. I lived with my mom and three sisters. And no brothers. But the neighborhood, you know, where I lived that day embraced me. So all the thugs, the pimps, the pushers, became my mentors, they became my friend.
You see my face change when you said about the drums. I was like, hang on.
You were a drummer too?
No, I wasn't. But it's just interesting. I find it interesting, obviously we're here to talk boxing. It's always good when someone's got a hidden talent, you know?
Oh yeah, man, drums were, that was the thing, man. You know, and it's crazy now. I was telling somebody this recently. The way our home was set up, okay, we lived in the middle, you had a family downstairs from us. You had another family upstairs. And then, of course, next door to them was the same type of situation. And now looking back, I had to be driving those people crazy, man. Because, you know, the sound, you know, of the drum and the wall were paper thin, you know what I mean? But not one time did they ever complain.
Did you play like with a group or a band or anything like that?
No, I the furthest I got, there was a guy that lived above me, and he was like one of my best friends. He had a cousin named Ricky, and Ricky was a lead guitar player.
Okay.
Phenomenal player. And there was times that he wanted to quit, and my older sister spoke to him, you know, because she knew he could play this thing. And, you know, encouraged him to keep going. And he could play the guitar with his teeth, man. And so one day he came and got me, you know, he told me he wanted to, you know, put on a performance in the neighborhood. And it's directly across the street. So the projects are here. Directly across the street were your regular houses and your apartments or what have you. And we all went out, you know, the drums, the guitars, and, you know, people started to come. And Brick House was like the record back then at that time. And he gave me the pointers, what to do, you know, how to chime in, the whole nine. And next thing you know, I thought it was just going to be us and more like a practice session, but we ended up doing a little mini concert outside, you know.
How cool.
And yeah, and so that was my first introduction to, you know, jamming, you know what I mean? And
did you box?
Yes. I started out at Bennett Starter Rec Center in the same area that I told you about. But I was a young kid. I never fought open class or nothing like that there. Mine was more JOs and novice.
Did you get the pre-fight fear?
You're always nervous. You know what I mean? I mean, the first time that I ever even put on a pair of gloves, I had a friend in the neighborhood. His name was Barry Braxton. They took us from the baseball diamond to the gym to introduce us to boxing. And I got my behind handed to me, right? You know what I mean? It looked easy. You know, you don't know if you've never done it before. You don't know how to hold your hands the whole nine. You know, this dude was bigger than me. He was strong than me the whole nine. And so that was my introduction to, that's my introduction to boxing.
Yeah.
This is one of your future stars too. That's hey. Patrick Harris.
Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you.
Hey, Pay. You good? All right. And pretty much, you know, it started on, you know, it started me on my craft, my journey, you know. And mine was very, very short-lived. I kept trying to get back to the boxing thing, you know, streets calling you, girls calling you, everything, you know, I'm lost. I don't know what to do, where to go. And I think the last time I was in the gym, I think I was about 17 years old. And there was another kid in the area named Marvin Lee.
Okay.
The place that we trained at was number 14 Boys and Girls Club off of Minnesota Avenue. This dude was taking karate. So when you walk into the place, and it later became Discount Mart store. Okay. When you walk into the place, you have the heart of the center, which is, you know, pool tables, tennis tables, that type of thing. Off to the right, the boxing. Left, karate dojo, weightlifting. Marvin came over, he's about 14 or 15 years old, and he asked me, could I teach him how to box? He was taking karate at the time. And I didn't know nothing about teaching nobody how to box, man. You know, I said, the only thing I can do is show you what it is that I know. And so his instructor, which all the coaches, most of the coaches down there, instructors were police officers.
Okay.
And he told me it was cool, you know, he didn't have a problem with it. So I didn't want to ruffle the feathers of the coach in the boxing gym. He would come after everybody was gone, it'd just be him and I in the gym alone. And I would put his combinations into numbers and things of this nature. When I did that, he started to fight better. You know what I mean? And his first fight was in C. Pleasant, Maryland. He stops this kid. And I've been chasing the high ever since. That's what happened.
Wow, that's great. And then, so... do you still use that same pattern of combinations and numbers? Did you still?
No, I don't. I don't. See, I did that. That was more covert because I didn't want to get in trouble, you know, with the coach.
Yeah.
So I would, you know, throw my hands up, you know, give symbols and numbers with my hands, and only him and I knew what we were talking about. You know what I mean? Because I didn't know that it was wrong. I didn't want to be wrong. I didn't want to, you know, step on my coach's toes or nothing like that. This was just somebody to ask for help, yeah. And this was my way of helping him. And lo and behold, he started doing this thing. A couple other fighters in the gym caught on to it. One of them went to the military. He did pretty good in the military. But Marvin, he was the one. He was the first. And I have been chasing that high ever since.
That's brilliant. Tell me about the Peterson brothers when they first came. Did they come together? Did you meet them together at the same time?
No.
One came first.
Their brother-in-law now, which is Boogie Harris, he used to tell me about him all the time, more Lamont than Anthony. And he brought him to the gym one day, and they were, I think, just coming out of foster care system. And he brought him to the gym, and I met Lamont first. Fell in love with the little dude, you know, because he, the way he approached, you know, what it was he was doing, he was a hard worker. He was young, and you could tell him something, maybe a couple of times, man, he'd get it, you know, get it. He'd get it and have it down almost. And his comprehension skills at that time for somebody that young, it was crazy. And I thought even back then that if he stayed the course, he was going to become world champion, which he did. And one of the days that I swung past their house, I was going to get him, pick him up, and Anthony ran downstairs. And he said he wanted to come to the gym too. So I ended up taking like three or four of them to the gym. Two of them ended up staying. It was three boys and one girl at the time. And the two to stay were Anthony and Lamont. And they were the ones who excelled.
And they've done all right, haven't they?
They did great.
So at what point did you realize that you had it as a coach? Was that that first fight when you gave the guy the...
I never even really looked, to be honest with you, I never really even looked at myself, you know, as being, I was just helping, you know what I mean? Sure. And it didn't just start with them, you know, before, you know, I actually went into a gym setting doing this. I was doing it in the streets, you know what I mean? Even if a kid had a dispute or something, you know, I'd make him throw the gloves on and, you know, we're going to get it out the way right here, right now, you know what I mean? And this was all during the time I was living over on Good Hope Road in Southeast. And I used to have the kids on the playground all the time, you know, let them go, you know? And when I got to Lincoln School, and started coaching, volunteered for Lincoln and coaching. That's when I sort of started feeling like a coach, a real teacher. And I don't even like to call myself a coach. I'd rather call myself a teacher.
Do you know what? Then you must get very annoyed when all these boxing fans say there's no teachers left in boxing.
That's bull. You got a few now. It's not, you don't have the Eddie Futches anymore, like back then.
Because it's a younger generation, isn't it? When you talk about Eddie Futch, you talk obviously about Angelo Dundee, you talk about Emmanuel.
Which was one of my mentors, Emmanuel. I had a chance to meet Angelo Dundee and speak with him. Mr. George Washington from New York was a legendary trainer. You look at here in D.C., Ham Johnson, Adrian Davis, Mr. Dave Jacobs, Mr. Greenham, Mr. Dunlap, Mr. Finley. There were legendary coaches and trainers here as well.
I'm starting to think, though, that this thing about there are no teachers left in boxing is just an insult because, you know, there's people who do what you do around the world where they take kids and they straighten them out, and that's teaching. Whether they become world champions or not, it's another thing, but obviously there's many different success stories from a boxing gym, and not all of them wind up with a world title.
Absolutely. You have, to be honest with you, you got a lot of coaches that the world never even have seen or know about that were directly responsible for producing most of the world champions that you see or have seen on TV. The faceless, the nameless, the fighter know who they are, you know, and maybe some of the people that ended up with those fighters know who they are. But, hell, you had legendary coaches in the amateurs that I've seen bring kids from ground zero all the way up to contention, be it in the amateurs or the pros, and never get credit for it. Nobody knows who they are.
Because you're not just a pro gym or just a pro coach either, are you?
I did a lot of time under USA Boxing. I was a member of the national team for many years. You know, I had a chance to work with, you know, a lot of your stars of boxing in the amateurs, a lot of them. I had a chance to coach against a lot of the stars of boxing internationally and domestically.
Yeah, so what kind of era, what year period were you, have you been involved with the USA setup?
I think I started actually on a national team, I want to say from 2000 or 2001 to about 2012 or 13.
And who were some of the better kids that passed through that period?
Course, you know, some of your world more recognizable names would be, you know, of course, Lamont, Anthony, you had Earl Spence, Jesse Hart, Marcus Brown, Joseph Diaz, Rasheed Warren, Adrian Broner, Sean Porter, Jamel Herring, Javonte Davis. I mean, the list go on and on and on. And the ones that I work against, like Rigondeaux, Lomachenko, Mario Kindelan, Amir Khan, in the amateurs and the pros, Anthony Joshua. I mean, it was just so many.
Yeah, sure. Was there, in terms of the U.S. guys, who would you put in that sort of top bracket, the top two or three most naturally... I'm not sure you say naturally gifted, because then you're taking out the guys that put in the work as well. Two or three of the guys that shone the brightest, where you were looking at them as top amateurs thinking, wow, you've got it.
Lamont. Earl Spence. They had a kid from Cincinnati. They made an Olympic team in, I believe, 2000, which was Ricardo Williams.
Yeah, sure.
Rasheed Warren was special. Gary Russell was a special fighter.
You mentioned Broner a little while ago. What was he like as a younger guy, because obviously we've seen the fully fledged Broner since, and he's made numerous headlines. Was he hard work, or was he on board with the discipline?
When he was young, you know, he was just a regular kid. You know, he liked to run, play, laugh, joke. He was a prankster. I think he bypassed the open class. The last time he was in fighting, I believe Adrian was still like a J.O., something like that there. But we got him here. He got into something in Cincinnati, and Mike called me up and wanted to send him up here. So myself and Boogie took him under our wings. He actually lived with Boogie for a few years. And we would train him here and send him back home like on a Thursday, maybe at the latest on a Friday. He would fight Saturday and be back here Monday or Tuesday. So this went on. This went on for years, up to the point where he got to major TV.
Okay.
And he started fighting. We would always go support him. He would come and support the guys. And then he hit that run where we didn't see him anymore. And he lost to Marcos Maidana.
Yeah.
After that loss to Maidana, he came back to the gym. And it was crazy because it was evening and he was sitting on the ring. When I walked in the door and I saw him, I said, what are you doing here? You know, we laughed and talked. He said, I need y'all to go back with me. You and Coach Boog, I need you to go back with me. And we went back. He went on his tear again, started winning again. He left again. He lost to Sean Porter. After he lost to Sean, he called again. Need to come back to the gym again.
I can see it.
Came back, we resurrected him again. He won another world title. And then after that, he was gone again, and the rest is history. But in fact, I talked to him last week.
Okay.
Yeah, he gave me a call last week.
So you got a soft spot for him?
Oh, yeah, I love him. You know what I mean? And to be honest with you, the majority of fighters that I've ever came in contact with, that we actually ever had trained, you know, we got mad love for him.
So paint the picture then, because the world out there, outside of these walls, isn't a huge fan of Broner because of his antics and that kind of stuff. What's
that,
like?
that is his alter ego. You know, Adrian, if you sit down and talk to him, if it's just us in this room, you'll see a whole nother side of this guy. Whole nother side of him. So that's the Adrian that I know. That's the Adrian that I love. That's the Adrian that I'm familiar with. Yeah. You know, I get selling your game or your craft or, you know, or what have you. But that's not who he is. Adrian is super cool. I can say the same thing about Javante. People see him, you know, that don't know him. You think these dudes are assholes. But they're you know, super cool, man.
Yeah, I suppose the knock on Javante is everyone wants all those guys to fight each other, and it's just not happening. With him, Ryan Garcia, Devin Haney, and now Kambosos.
And listen, and I say this to that. You've never seen or heard of Javante turning out a fight from anyone. You know, whoever they put in front of him, that's who he fight. Now, would I like to see him fight them guys? As a boxing fan, absolutely. You know, I don't care who it is. In that weight class of fighters, which is a pool of talent, I just think that he is the best.
You mentioned a few notable trainers and a few guys that might have gone under the radar. What does make a good trainer? What are the ingredients that people need?
Passion. Definitely the knowledge of the game and the history of it. Sacrifice, because it takes a lot, and being steadfast, focus on what you're doing. Just like anything else, it could get stale. You have to find a way to keep that fire burning, you know, be it through you working hard at your craft or developing or getting fighters that are really into learning the craft or being about the craft.
When you talk about passion, it can be difficult in this business. I mean, we talked about it off camera at the start there. It's easy to get burnt out by too much boxing. So it's a fine line, isn't it, between maintaining your passion and doing something you love rather than having it as a job and something where you punch in and punch out.
Absolutely. I was Sean Porter, which I considered to be like a nephew to me. And I had to sit down with him and we talked a bunch. And Sean is, to me, you know, and he had a knock on him. You know, he didn't have the traditional style of boxing. He was gritty. He was tough. You know, but to me, he was one of the most difficult fighters that you had to prepare for in boxing. His courage is unmistakable, you know what I mean? He had a knack of breaking fighters down, even at a higher weight class, because in the amateurs he was 165, fighting 165. He was never really a 165 pounder.
He fought Usyk in the amateurs, didn't he?
He beat him.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at the list of people that this guy has fought in the amateurs and the pros, and not only fought them, beat a lot of them, and the ones he lost to was very close. It was outstanding, you know, and in his own right, to me, he was a special fighter. Still is. A formidable for anybody. But I think that some of the names that I called earlier, and the list is a broader list than that, you know. But when you think about people like Georgie Benton,
yeah,
you know, trainers like that, trainers like Emmanuel, they had that factor, you know. They were men. They spoke. Fighters listened to them. They led. You didn't see them really hanging out with the fighters and that. They did their job, and that was it, and that was all. And you don't see that, you know, in bulk anymore.
Weren't you like a surrogate dad to the Petersons, though? Or was that different because you had them from that age?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Weren't you like a surrogate dad to the Petersons?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was, I just fell in love with them, you know, and they were like my own. I brought them into my family.
Yeah.
You know, you have coaches like that.
Yeah.
And a coach or a trainer or a teacher, they become your surrogate.
And also, I suppose every partnership is different, right? So you and Broner, maybe that's a bad example because you go back a long way, but you and a good guy coming off the street to be training with you now who's 25 years old and got some miles under his belt is different to you starting out a kid who's 10 years old.
Yeah.
Like your journey will be different.
Yeah, because you know, it's about growth, it's about nurturing. You're protecting them. They're, you know, at that age, you're fragile. Mm. You're vulnerable. As opposed to a grown man, 25, 28, you know, 30 years old. It's a big difference. And you tend to learn more at a young age than you would at those older ages.
Yeah, of course.
You know, a lot of people are just stuck in their ways, man. Whereas though that seed, you can, you know, rim and bring them up, you know, pretty much any kind of way you want to.
When you've got a fighter like Lamont, who you're emotionally invested in, having been on such a big journey, and he's in there swapping punches with someone, is there a paternal side in you that's thinking, or is it? Do you see him? You know, someone you want to look after during a fight, or do you see him as a client and a, you know, a fighter that you're coaching?
No, you definitely want. I protect. Or do my best to protect every fighter the same. But no, if you're asking me, do my emotions as a parent take over from being a professional in that corner? No. I'm pretty much fixed and focused on that. I don't get caught up in the crowd. I don't get caught up in my feelings. If they get hurt, if they get dropped, it's a part of the business, is what we do. And I think that is one of the things that get me over in this game, you know, because when the lights cut on, crowd cheering and, you know, or booing, and a lot of corners panic.
Yeah.
Doing situations like that. And then when you turn around and make an emotional decision opposite a professional decision, then the emotion is a lot of times supersedes your intelligence, and then that decision is wrong.
Did you slap Lamont a lot of times in the corner, or is it just one time that I see?
I knew him.
Yeah.
I knew what got him going. That slap wasn't to hurt him. It was just to wake him up. You know what I mean? And Lamont was one of them type of fighters that respond different from other fighters.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
You have some that may even cower to something like that, but I know my guys, every last one of them. I know all their strengths. I know all their weaknesses.
And how did he react to that in that particular time?
You saw it. And right after that, he went on here and took care of his business.
I was here in D.C. when Lamont fought Amir Khan, who you mentioned, obviously, you were against related to that, you mentioned earlier about corner v. corner. Obviously, on that particular night, you were up against Freddie Roach. Do you see that as a battle when you're going into a fight, or do you see it as your guy against his guy, or do you see it as, do you try to think what Freddie's going to do and what he gets his guys to do?
I'm pretty much confident what it is that I do, you know, and whatever they bring to the table, they bring to the table. I don't tend to worry about them as much as I'm on our preparation, what it is we need to do. I'm never arrogant. I'm never cocky. I'm just confident. I know Freddie. Good man. He's a friend. In fact, Freddie and I were on the U.S. team helping the U.S. Olympians get ready for the Olympic Games, along with Mike Stafford, Kenny Porter, Ron Sims. But, yes, and I welcome that challenge, and I'm glad it was Freddie in the corner. You know, that was fighter versus fighter. That was corner versus corner. That was instructions versus instructions. And to be able to be on that battlefield with these legendary people, yeah, I loved it, man.
That was a hell of a fight as well.
One hell of a Donnybrook. It was one hell of a Donnybrook, man.
And controversial in a lot of respects.
It was made to be controversial, but not in my book. You know, I thought the right man won. I thought it was a heated and a spirited battle, and it was tight. And if it would have swayed the other way, I would have been cool with it.
Do you get more adrenaline when you do those big nights and the big shows and the big fights in Vegas as opposed to doing a smaller show with some of the guys coming through?
Yeah, you know, it's levels to this thing. And when you get in front of millions and millions of people, if you're fighting on HBO as opposed to a gymnasium with a sporadic crowd, you know, 50 people, yeah, it's totally different. Way different. Fighting against John Brown, Junior Smith, or whatever, versus a Floyd Mayweather or Vladimir Klitschko or something, way different. Way different.
Because a lot of coaches would probably say, oh, it's the same, you know, a ring's a ring, we just need to concentrate on the job at hand. But obviously, like you mentioned there, the external factors are very different to react to, aren't they?
Very different. Very different. I've watched people in the corner, based on excitement and emotion, lose their voices, panic. Forget to get a mouthpiece to the fighter, forget to get in the corner, the whole nine. Whereas though here, you don't have that type of pressure. You got 30, 40, 50 people watching you, you know. Some on hell don't even really paying attention to the fight versus going in a fight, again, like I say, thousands upon thousands of people cheering, booing, cursing you. Millions at home watching, you know, both here and abroad. Lights, Jim Gray, and you know, just the icons of boxing there watching you as well. When Gervonta just fought his last fight, of course we were in L.A. And when I was going up the stairs, one of the first person I saw and gave me a point was Magic Johnson.
Right? Okay.
This is magic, man. You know what I mean? What can I say? This is magic, the best to ever do it at that position. You know what I mean? Then you saw Kevin Garnett. Then you saw Carmelo Anthony, Paul Pierce, Kenny Smith. These are legends, man. Sitting there watching you do your thing. You feel me? Yeah. And so if you're not equipped to deal with that, and if you let your emotions get in the way, you're going to panic. You know what I mean? And especially if you're not in control of what it is you're doing. If it get out of hand, you know, you don't know what to do. You're caught up into everything else except for focus and being fixed on your fighter and the fight itself.
And you've had to make those important calls. Obviously, you pulled Lamont out against Spence, didn't you? So that's one of those things where, you know, when you've got a fighter of Lamont's caliber, you think, you know, leave him in. He's got the ability to turn a fight around. But obviously, knowing him as you do, you've got to make a hard call and prepare for the repercussions, because not all fighters would be on board with you pulling them out either.
Yeah.
As we saw with Deontay Wilder chucking Mark Breland under the bus.
I think about that, right, for a second, right? Did I think Mark made the right decision, especially in that first fight? Absolutely. You know, And I would do it time and time again if I thought that it was inevitable that you were going to get hurt, or, you know, a situation like that, or that last punch could be the final punch, you know, in your life and or career that would do you your harm or damage. But it's a thin line. You know, we've seen fighters get hurt and for whatever reason be able to wheel themselves back in the fight, come back and win the fight. But you have to know your fighter. You have to know your athlete. And you have to, you know, have confidence in what it is that you do.
Yeah.
In order to make this thing happen.
And you have to know what you're up against.
And you have to know what you're up against. You know, I look at all kinds of things. And I communicate with the guys in the corner. We literally have conversations sometimes in the corner.
Yeah.
And then you look at the opponent. Is the opponent getting weaker? Are they on the same level as far as stamina is concerned? Or is the opponent that much stronger and that much more fit to continue on than your guy? You got to factor in all that.
Yeah, of course. Hey, how do you console yourself with the prospect of damage in boxing, whether it's someone getting hurt on fight night and being stretched from the ring, worst case scenario, or even the long-term damage? We talk about CTE now and punch drunk syndrome and stuff. How do you reconcile your involvement as a teacher, particularly to young kids coming through where these guys do pick up mileage through a career?
Well, of course, we've learned more, you know, over the years, and we're still learning, you know, as far as the sports, the after effects, the damages, you know, things of this nature. We don't spar as much, you know, as we used to, and then what we do, the rounds are much shorter than they used to be. You know, just trying to create some sort of a protocol, you know, of safety in the sports, because when you think about it, sparring per week, per month, per year, then your fights added on to that, your tournaments, especially if you're in the amateurs, it's a lot of blows, man.
Yep.
It's a lot of blows. So, you know, we try to teach the craft as best we can. You know, the name of this thing is boxing. You know, box first, fight last. You know, and that's how we want to approach this thing. Like I said, I take it you've seen fights that you may have felt went along too long. You feel me? You had the TV screaming or you about the fight. Stop the fight. You know, what are you looking at? Blah, blah, blah. And we've seen that too, you know, and I would say, in order to kind of curve that, or, you know, those situations, we just got to learn just to be better at what it is we do. You know, I feel, you know, I sympathize for a lot of the trainers because it was not their intent to put their fighter in a situation like that. Sure. Let's be real about that. You know, in their heart of hearts, they still think that, you know, in situations that you or I may look at and say, man, this shit should have been stopped a long time ago, they tend to let it go on further. You feel me? And so it's just a judgment call, man. And a lot of times you're damned if you do or you're damned if you don't. You hear people say, well, you stopped too early, right?
Yeah.
Then you hear others say that you should have stopped it a long time ago. You know what I mean? So you just have to use your better judgment.
Yeah, so I suppose I read this the other day and I saw this and it kind of made a lot of sense. Because people, you know, there's always this question, who should stop the fight? You know, should it be a doctor? Should it be the corner? Should it be the referee? And I kind of thought this made sense. So the referee calls the fight strictly on what's going on in the ring. You stop the fight based on you knowing about a fighter's backstory and how much mileage he's got. And
body language.
And how his camp's gone and that kind of, exactly that. So leave the referees to do it based on what's going on in the fight. But if you know the story, if you know your guy's had 40 fights and he's getting to the end of the line and he's taken a beating, then don't wait for the referee to say, oh, you know, he's not going to turn this round after 10 rounds. You know, he's got 2 rounds left. And after 7-8 rounds, you could say, no, it's not our night.
Yeah, exactly. Because you are the first line of defense.
Yeah.
You don't have to wait on the referee. You don't have to wait on the doctor. You don't have to even wait on the fighters to submit. You can get up there if you see something, if you feel something, despite of what the crowd going to say or what people will say after the fact, you have to do what's best for your fighter, you know, that you think is best for the fighter. So you get up and you stop it. You stop it.
How hard a decision is that? Is something that you've
It done? Is. It's very hard. You know what I mean? It's very hard. You'll sit there, and it's one of the hardest decisions you have to make. You know what I mean? But it's one of the easiest decisions to make also. You know, when you think about what could be or the after effects if you leave them in there long enough, you know, and women as well, you know. People, and it's ugly side of boxing, but people have been and do get killed in what it is we do. You know, and so you have to be very, very careful and cautious about, you know, how you approach this game.
People think you're related to Virgil, don't they?
Virgil think we're related. Be honest with you. You know what I mean? In fact, I had an aunt that I loved to death. God rest her soul. She just recently passed away. She gave me our family tree.
Okay.
And I don't know if I sent it to Virgil yet or what, but Virgil and I came up through the amateurs coaching together as well, you know, for years. One of my best friends. And
but no relation at all.
We hadn't found it out yet, but he's the area that he said he was coming from, you know, he had relatives coming from that area as well.
Okay.
And so I got the family tree. If I didn't send it to him, I'm gonna send it to him. And we've been discussing that for years, man. And he got the demeanor of my family, you know, the way he act, the way, you know, moves and things of this nature. So we always talk about that. In fact, when I first met Keisha Cole, her and Virgil was getting Virgil and introduced me to her. And I said, man, congratulations, you know, on everything. And I said, I don't know, but I might be your cousin as well. And
she, oh, your uncle.
She fell out. Yeah. She fell out on that. So that was cool, you know.
Yeah. So that's his famous daughter, right?
Yeah,
who's
that's
a singer.
Daughter.
Yeah.
And it's crazy how that all came about. You know what I mean? But like Bird said, sometimes life throw you them curves, man.
Well, I think, you know, she's doing you dirty because she should hire you as a drummer.
Right.
So you also, it's incredible the similarities, though, the fact that obviously you guys have got the same surname, obviously similar sort of origin stories, and then you've taken kids from nowhere and nothing right to the tippy top of the sport. It's great.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. Like I said, man, when we first connected in the amateurs, Dre was young, man. I mean, he was, what, 12 or something like that there? We always, for whatever reason, always been super cool with one another, and we were friends. And you know, when you think about the coaches, and I used to love going to the tournaments when we were younger because, you know, you had a chance to, you know, meet the coaches and, you know, interact with them, and they were cool. Nazim Richardson, Virgil Hunter, Mike Stafford, Kenny Porter. There were so many of them dudes, man, that, you know, we had good rapport, good relationships with, you know, and we literally grew up in the sport together.
Yeah, you were the new breed coming in.
We were a new breed coming in. And a lot of them we still, you know, keep in contact. We had a relationship where we still work together, some of them.
Have you ever gone against Virgil in the corner?
No. I've helped. Like Andre Rozier, he's another one. That's like a brother too. Andre had his nephew Curtis Stevens,
Showtime.
And Virg, of course, and Andre. We were in Reno, and Dre, as oftentimes we do, we help each other out in the corner. And it just so happened we wasn't fighting at that time. He needed somebody to help him in the corner, so I did the bucket and the stool thing. But I've never coached against Virg in the corner. No. I've, of course, been in against, like, Freddie Roach, the Garcia brothers, so many others that came up with us that I have been head-to-head with Nazim Richardson.
Would you relish going up against Virgil? Would you like that?
It all depends on who Virg has. You know, I don't care, you know, who we go up against, to be honest with you. If they have that hot fighter, you know, then, and I have a hot fighter that's in the same weight class, unlike the amateurs, we would always call each other to see, you know, if our top guys, what they weighed. So we would push one up, move one down.
Okay.
And that way we wouldn't clash in the local stuff.
Sure.
We would all meet up at the nationals and do what we do.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you fixed it.
Yeah, the fix was in, you know. It went by regions in the nationals. So if we were going up against, like, California's region, which is strong, we want to take our best teams from our region to get there. And you don't take your best team by eliminating each other in the locals, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you mob up, you do your thing, and then when you go out there, you're able to face them. That's how we always get to the top of the game in the amateurs.
How big of an issue is PEDs in boxing?
I really don't know. I don't think it is as widespread as people say it is, you know. But anytime you have, you know, money and stuff like that, there, of course, you can have situations that you may have people that know what it is they're doing and what they're taking. And then on the flip side of that, you know, you got all these new supplements and vitamins and, you know, things of this nature. And they're all made in the same factories or processing camps as the PEDs are made in. So you never know what's happening. You know, my thing was with, especially in the amateurs, USA Boxing, if you guys know what's wrong to take, then write a list of supplements or what have you that the people can take that are legal.
Sure. Yeah, because what was the issue with Lamont back in the day?
They try to say that he had something. They never did tell us what it was that he had.
Because this was for a Khan rematch, wasn't it?
For a Khan rematch. And, you know, we had heard all kinds of stories. And you think about that Khan situation. First, it was the man in the black hat. It was
Mustafa.
It was the referee. It was just everybody.
Yeah.
You know? That really pissed me off because it took away from what happened that night. That was a special night. You know what I mean? It was never none of that stuff, man. All we know was that, you know, they said it was something in the system. They didn't know what the hell it was. But instead of me, again, going off emotion, and I was mad as hell going off emotion because the way they were trying to treat him, you know, and drag his name through the mud the whole nine, and he didn't deserve that. So we got smart. We went and got specialists that specialize in endocrinologists that specialize in this area, and we didn't get no quack doctors. We got, you know, high-level people from Johns Hopkins, you know, it's all over. And they all, I believe it was like four or five of them, came back with the same results and the same findings, with that there was no way, no how, that he had anything in the system that he cheated with.
Anthony fought last year, right?
Yes.
Is he still fighting? Is he active?
He's still fighting. He's still fighting as of now.
Do you want him to stop?
And that's going to be totally up to him.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Lamont got a lot of plaudits for going out when he went out, saying, you know, the time's right. It's, you know, a good time to go. Have we seen the last of Lamont?
I think he's at peace with himself and what he's done.
You know, what's he doing now?
Things, it's like training, trains fighters.
In
he's
here.
Into the wellness thing. No, he has his own thing flying.
Okay.
He's into the wellness thing, and he seems to be doing well.
Okay. And who else have you got in here at the minute?
Well, you just met Patrick Harris. You have Isaac Dogbay, another one of you guys' countrymen.
Yeah.
Here we work with Javante Davis, Demetrius Ballard is out there, Franchon Cruz. So we constantly work with fighters all the time.
And you did work with Fernando Guerrero, right?
Fernando Guerrero. I thought that he was going to be a superstar.
Yeah, I think a lot
really,
of people
really, really, really thought he was going to be a superstar. Even before he really became a contender in the city of Salisbury, Fernando used to sell arenas out, man. And up in one day, you know, he wanted to, you know, switch up, you know, the camp, you know, what have you. So once that happened, I went one direction. In fact, I left and went to Paris with the U.S. team.
Okay.
We fought in a four nations duel versus Ukraine, Hungary, France, and it was us. And Ukraine, of course, had Usyk and Lomachenko on there.
Yeah.
At the time, I had Errol Spence. I had Caleb was on that squad, but I don't think Caleb made that trip. And I want to say Joseph Diaz might have been on that team also. But, yeah, man.
Fernando,
I thought he was going to be a superstar. I really, really did, man.
Where did it go wrong?
Well, he wanted to change some things up. He wanted to, you know, have his own camp away from here, which this is where his career started at, his professional career started at. And I think it's something like 18, 19-0 or something like that. Then 19-0.
Yeah.
And when he started talking like that, and when, you know, when they get to the mindset that, you know, I'm going to do me and, you know, what have you, okay, no problem. You know what I mean? So I went one direction. He went another direction. Had a couple of fights he didn't do as well, but he won. And then he fought Greatest Brewer. And the ironic thing about that fight was he fought Brewer. I got a call from one of the reporters. Reporter, you know, asked about the fight coming up, blah, blah, blah. And he didn't know that we wasn't together. And when he found out, he said, man, that can be real dangerous, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then I said, Fernando has a problem with rangy guys, throw right hands, and kind of awkward like. But I wish him well. That's where I left it at. So the night of the fight, I get a phone call. You watching the fight? No. And I actually forgot about the fight was coming on. Hey, man, Fernando, man, he don't look good. And while he was talking to me, it's over. And that's what, how the conversation went, right? And then when I turned the highlights on, I saw what happened. And it all went downhill from there.
Is it a skill that trainers find easy training southpaws as opposed to orthodox? Or when someone comes at you with a southpaw stance, do you roll your eyes and think, oh, God?
Mm-mm. I've never had a problem with either or. Even fighters that are very unorthodox, and I never had a problem with no fighter. You know what I mean? I figure in boxing, you got to learn it all.
Yeah.
You can't just deal with orthodox fighters, southpaws, short fighters, tall fighters, awkward fighters, you know, fighters that are very skilled. You got to be able to deal with all of them.
And you had heavyweight Tony Thompson for a bit.
I did. And then
he was good.
I got Tony early on. You know, well, I got Tony when Tony was born here. I knew Tony. Tony yeah. knew us. But as a pro, and when they first brought him to me, his manager then asked me, what did I think about him? I said, I don't. And I said, what's going on? And he told me. I said, well, hell, we can try it, you know what I mean? And so we tried it, and lo and behold, he went out and he started stopping dudes, man. He exceeded my expectation of what he was going to be. And he kept going and kept beating all these top guys and knocking them out and stopping them or beating them. Then we got to Vladimir. And before Vladimir, we fought. Who was the guy that gave us the right to fight Vladimir? He was in Germany. Tony stopped him. He was like the guy over there.
Not Dimitrenko.
No.
I can't think of who
you
it was.
Know, you would know the name. I can't think of the name right now, but Tony stopped him. And then that gave us the right to fight Vladimir Klitschko.
Were you with him for the David Price fights? In Liverpool?
No.
You parted ways by then?
Yeah. No, that was after Vladimir Klitschko?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was gone.
Yeah, I think they brought in... I think they brought in David Price to do... Or I think David Price brought Tony Thompson in to try and do a better job than Vladimir did.
Mm.
And it backfired.
Mm. Yeah, no, Tony could fight, man. He could fight.
When you talk about, obviously, the headbangers gym and running the show here, in modern day boxing, we have S&C coaches, we have, nutritionists, all the parts. Do you run the show from top to bottom with your guys, or do you let them do other things elsewhere with
other
people?
Now they do other things elsewhere with other people. Isaac has, and they do a lot of nutritional work for top rank, Miss Paulina. And she's phenomenal. You know,
in terms of the S&C, do you work with the guys to say, you know, what you want from them or what they need to do, or do you leave it as a separate part where that you just want them to come here in shape, ready to go?
No, well, we work them, you know what I mean? And for the most part, I can always say we used to hang our hat on that. We used to always be in shape and be ready to go, you know? And some of them have personal trainers that they deal with, you know, work with. I had the pleasure of being a member of the U.S. national team, and so I was around some of the greatest physical trainers around, you know?
Yep.
And I learned a lot over the years. You know, so I do what I do in here. If I know someone needs some little extra or, you know, a little special attention, then we give them what they need.
You're a very calculated and methodical guy to talk to and speak to. There must have been times where life's not gone your way. What's been the worst moment of your life? What's the worst experience you've gone through?
I've seen in boxing?
No, in life.
Oh, just in life in general.
Like some adversity you faced. I mean, I'll hold my hands up. I always go to my divorce as my worst thing.
There have been a few, you know what I mean? But I think the greatest thing, adverse situation that I had was, speaking of Tony Thompson, we were in L.A., 3 o'clock, 3:30 in the morning. I was in my room and I was asleep. I get a phone call, and it was Boogie. And he said, man, your mom been trying to get in contact with you. He said, your sister passed away. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, your sister passed away. It was my oldest sister. And we were very, very close. We were very close. I mean, it's like one of my best friends ever. And my protector and my defender. And when he said that, of course, it took me for a loop.
Yeah.
I'm sitting there, I don't know what to do. And I cried my eyes out. And I called home, called my mom. And I'm talking about, I'm boohooing, man. And still, I got to find a way to get myself together, because we still got to perform. Tony was going to fight at the Playboy Mansion. And she had called me one day, left me a voicemail, and I heard her on the voice machine. And I was going to answer the phone, but I was headed to the shower. So I said, I'll give her a call later. And I never did get a chance to talk to her. And I think that was one of the worst things that ever happened to me, man.
Was that unexpected? She hadn't been ill or anything?
Not that I know of. She hadn't been ill or nothing. She died from thrombosis, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow.
And, you know, it just came out of the blue. And that message she left me, she was just saying, hey, brother. She said, I'll just call and check on you. You know, I think she said something pertaining to me and the boys or me and the fire. I'll just call and check on you, da-da-da. And she said, I love you. You know what I mean? And that was it, man. And I never got a chance to talk to her again. And it was just like you and I talking today. And then you walk out this door, and hours later, somebody tell me you got killed or you died.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, that.
I mean, to be fair, it could happen out there.
Yeah.
I see those streets out there.
Yeah. Because this is the hood now. But nevertheless, that was one of the times in history that, you know, along this journey that really, you know, messed me up, man.
Yeah, of course. And how'd you overcome that? Is it time and just to,
It's crazy because, you know, even though we were at the world famous Playboy Mansion, you know, had all the stars walking around, but I'm just kind of like floating, you know what I mean? I'm there, but I'm not there. And then I had to come back home. I had to get myself together, actually, and say, okay, I can't do nothing for her anymore but pray.
Yeah.
But I still got a mission in front of me, so I got to complete this mission. So I had to find a way to, you know, find that spot, that calm zone, you know, and focus, get Tony through the fight. And we had another fighter in front of that car. Get them through the fight and come on back home. but I had another fight to go to when I got off the plane.
Wow.
So we got that out the way. And then finally, I got to my mom's house, you know, with my family and all.
Wow, thanks for sharing that. That's knocked me for a flip. It was real sad. On the flip side, what about some of the highs? And, you know, you can obviously include fights like this. Obviously, we talked about Lamont with Amir, but what were the other high points, or what have been some of the high points where you're like, you said right at the start, you know, you've been chasing that high ever since.
That,
what have been the biggest highs?
That, my kids being born, definitely was a big high to me.
Do they box?
One of them started, but he loved the women and he loved, you know, hanging out more than the game. Yeah, you know, he can fight, but that's his thing. Definitely that Amir Khan fight was outstanding. It was memorable. It was magical. And Marvin Lee, his first fight when he got a stoppage. Those were the two in boxing, I think, may have been the most memorable, good feeling things that happened in boxing.
What about now? So what part of the job do you like now the most? Is it fight night, or is it the, you know, when you look out there and you see the guys wrapping their hands off the streets on the straight and narrow, does that give you a good feeling?
Yeah, what gives me a good feeling now is, you know, and think about this, when we first started out, we were in a storage room that was no bigger than this office in that section out there.
Okay.
And we had cockroaches in there. We had some, I don't know what it was in the barrels, but it stained the floor. We had a makeshift ring that was made out of fencing pipe. And we had a ton of kids. And from that to this palace right here, and the one we have uptown, so we got a new one getting ready to go online uptown. It's just, it's pretty. It was a lot of work that went into that,
yeah.
You know, and a lot of sacrifice that went into it. And I think that, you know, is memorable. And so when you see, like, Franchon and some of these other ones that, you know, came through the system that's growing and still growing, some of the ones that, you know, there's only been a few that actually come back and help, you know, things like that, and make you feel good, you know what I mean? Because this was a seed planted a long time ago.
Yeah, because obviously, you know, I talked a bit about the damage that fighters have and sustain from the sport, but I'll always reconcile myself with saying it helps far more people than it takes away from. I'd like to believe that anyway, in terms of giving these guys not just your stereotypical way out, but to give them a different path and a different mindset.
Yeah, and that's the beauty about boxing. Boxing doesn't discriminate. You know, boxing to take the lows of the low, highs of the high, and give everybody that chance. You know, you don't hear ex-felons and ex-drug abusers in Wimbledon, or, you know, at the Breeders' Cup, you know, or, you know, Churchill Downs, and, you know, things of this nature. You feel me? So boxing is that, and it's like almost like an underground sport, man. You know, it's that sport that it don't care what you are, who you are, what your background was, it'll give you a chance. You know what I mean? And that's why I like boxing.
Yeah. And just one last thing I just wanted to cover with you. You mentioned history there. And obviously, when we started talking, we were talking about some of those great light heavyweights from the 1970s and early 80s. Is there a period of time, or are there particular fighters that you really have admired, respected, or even idolized over the years?
Let me say this, and it's a few on my list. Like my mom, and, you know, I'm gonna veer off a little bit, but my mom and Harriet Tubman are my two biggest heroes. Right? I love, you know, my mom, you know, with the kids and the projects and the way she maneuvered and did what she did and got us through, you know what I mean? Nobody knew, you know, how hard it was for her. And I took it for granted. I didn't know no better. Harriet Tubman, who do you know that had saved themselves and in an unselfish manner went back time and time again to save others, which could have meant her life, you know what I mean? Now, you know the people that she saved, the initial group of people that she saved. But think about how many generations did she preserve and did she save by saving those initial people? Because they had kids. Their kids had kids and so on and so forth.
Sure.
So she may be responsible for millions, hundreds of thousands, millions of lives, you know? But when you look at fighters like Tom, what is it, Molyneux?
Tom Molyneux, yeah, yeah.
Tom Molyneux, right? Born in the 1700s in Virginia. Fought his way out of slavery. The slave master's son won a ton of money, maybe $100,000+. Molyneux got $500, and think back then, got himself out of slavery, went to New York, bust everybody up. He's the first champ in America. Bust everybody up, got on a boat. Look, I'm going to Europe. I'm going to, you know, get some of the smoke over there, you know? Busted everybody up till he met the other guy. And really put him down, and he had a long count. And these cats going in like 40-some-odd rounds, but if it was called correctly, Molyneux, he beat him. The first time, second time he got slaughtered, you know what I mean? But the first time he really won the fight, you know? And so fighters like him, that majority of people don't know about. Jack Johnson, to fight under those circumstances against white, at that time, all races America almost, guns, calling him out his name, and to be able to perform that way he did with a smile on his face, bro, that was crazy. So those two, you know, at the top of the list. The ones that I was in awe about was Ray Robinson, which is my all-time favorite. Benny Leonard, which was a master boxer. Very few people know about him. Willie Pep, another boxer. Henry Armstrong. Reuben Hurricane Carter. Sugar Ray Leonard. Definitely Alexis Arguello. And Ali had to be, you know, at the top of the list for me at the time.
That's a brilliant list.
Yeah.
Brilliant
yeah.
list. So you like strong, independent guys that run their own race?
Run their own thing that doesn't cower down to the pressures of society or what people think you should be. To have the courage to step up, you know, to injustice, which is one of the things that I loved about Ali and I loved about Reuben Hurricane Carter. The man knew that he was guilty of no crime. He knew he was innocent, you know, and they threw him in a hole. You gonna wear these clothes? No, I'm not wearing those. I'm not a prisoner. You're not gonna put me in the same category as these thugs and murderers and rapists or what have you. I'm guilty of no crime. And he made a stand. He did his whole stint in jail, which he shouldn't have never been. Whole stint in jail, and he lived himself and carried himself upright like a man should. So I respect him.
There are stories that he was a bad dude, but obviously there's a difference between being a bad dude and a killer.
Yeah, you could be a bad guy in people's eyes or what have you, or you may have done some things. No man alive is perfect. You know, and we've all got, you know, a couple of things you may want to sweep away or sweep under the rug or what have you. But nevertheless, as far as him being that guy that they said he was, he wasn't. He didn't compromise that.
What are you like? Are you as peaceful and cerebral as you come across now, or do you get wild? Like, obviously, we've seen you slap them on in the face. So I've gone back to that again, but... Like, do you have a different side, or is this you just
chill? This is me all day, every day. You know what I mean? Just chill, you know? But just like anybody else, of course, You got your own demons you got to fight. We all got them. You know what I mean? And you got to find a way to slay them, you know, at the time. You know, and they're going to constantly come. But nevertheless, man, you are who you are. And wherever you go, you're going to take yourself with you.
Well, I'm really grateful for your time today. You actually have a gym full of people waiting for you. So I'm
going to leave
you
to get some work. Thanks for coming down.
Man, thank you so much for making the time. I appreciate it. I
appreciate the love.
So I mentioned at the top there that it was great to see Barry in the gym, and I felt hugely welcomed. It was great to spend some time talking with him. I really enjoyed this chat, really good sort of top trainer chat. And really appreciated his time, making time to see me. As I mentioned, that was part of my trip to the USA. I have done a sort of 40-minute podcast about my trip to the US on Patreon. It's about life as a struggling boxing journalist, life on the road. By all means, visit patreon.com/TrisDixon. And it helps you support the podcast, and there is bonus material and episodes go up early, etc. This podcast is brought to you by Hanson Lee Resourcing, who were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Blaz and the gang find you the best people, but they will help you retain them, and you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Dell from Delco Safety Compliance, who are a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide. They provide expert impartial advice on all aspects of fire, health and safety compliance, and you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. And I should be meeting up with Blaz and Derek in Cardiff this weekend as we get to go to see Chris Eubank against Liam Williams. So if you see us over there, come and say hello. Really hope you enjoyed this episode with Barry Hunter this week. You can vote for Boxer Life Stories at the Sports Podcast Awards website. We're up for Best Combat Sports Podcast. I don't know that we're doing, or I'm doing that well in terms of the votes. So if you want to lend a hand, by all means, go across to sportspodcastawards.com and click on Best Sports Combat Podcast and click on Boxer Life Stories. You can find me at Tris Dixon on Twitter and Instagram. And you can find Boxer Life Stories on Facebook and Instagram too. We'll be back next week.